This is Janet Dallet, Encounter with the Dark Gods, 23 November 1991, tape 2 of 3.
The rescue charter?
Yeah.
It's, I mentioned it a little bit about it in the last chapter of Saturday's Child. I could, I first became aware of it through a handout from the Poor Townsend domestic violence people. Steiner, that's the name I'm trying to think about is what's his first? It's not Rudolf Steiner, it's another Steiner. Claude Steiner, yeah. Yeah, and I looked into the literature. I first of all asked, you know, where did this handout come from? What's the source, so I can cite it, and nobody seemed to know. It just was going the round. And so I went and looked up everything I could find of Steiner's work, and he just mentions it very briefly. It comes from Eric Burns' ideas. It's an extension of Eric Burns' ideas. And the way Steiner talks about it very briefly is that there are these three things within us, the rescuer, the abuser, and the victim, and he talks about how particularly in the helping professions this it can be a terrible thing to get caught in. And it really caught me when I read about it, because it felt like a shadow side of the Christian Trinity. I could see the Christian rescuer, savior, and victim in Christ, and then the persecutor, Yahweh, and the persecutor. And it also echoed to things I experienced within myself, which in that chapter I've referred to as Votan, which is really the unredeemed, totally unredeemed nature of God, untransformed.
Was that that final day parallel to that experience with that woman being taken by the cult people, where you had the victims?
Yep.
And you were the baby kind of victim.
Yep. You got it. You got it. Right. That's right. That's right. And it was an ultimate persecutor victim situation. That's right. That's right. Exactly. And it usually you do on one level or another.
It's a pretty interesting dynamic.
I think very common. Very, very common.
I can see that really operating in the world of politics. I look at it in terms of relating to that. Is she following?
It's true. It is.
I would think of how the Congress rescued climate departments away. All these men rescued one man.
Evil, thy name is woman.
She's probably the personification of Lilith, I guess.
Yeah, she certainly was living some Lilith stuff. Well, is this a good lunch break place? So we'll all be back at, that still is no insurance against such things happening. But if there is any help with it, it's there. That reminds me of Edinger's book on Goethe's Faust, in which he talks about Faust as really the carrying the problem of modern man. It's this stuff that we're talking about, having to come to terms with the devil. And there's one place in there where some women come to Faust in the dead of night, and they have these There are four of them. They have these different German names. One is need, and one is debt. I've forgotten what one of them is. But the crucial one is care, because three of them he doesn't let in, but care creeps in through the keyhole. And he kicks her out. I mean, he does not accept her. And this is the point at which Enger feels this is his fatal flaw, and this is where we can learn from the Faust story that care in dealing with this material is the thing that can redeem it, or one of the things that can redeem it for us. I know the one that I couldn't think of is guilt, and I had written what I wrote in this book about the necessity of carrying guilt, not just trying to get rid of guilt, but carrying it before I read that. But I was very happy to hear that confirmation of how important it is to not just try to cut off from guilt. Yeah.
A sentence on page 82, growing up with a narcissistic mother sharpened her intuitive gift to a fine point.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Janet to talk about how that happened and what that's about, and this idea of with a narcissistic mother and know some things about intuition. I'm really curious about how those two, I think I have a sense of that, but
I'm interested in hearing. Well, a narcissistic parent demands, with a narcissistic parent, the parent is always at the center, and the parent's wishes and needs are the things that must always be met by the child. And the child learns that very, very young, and learns, and of course the parent is not aware of that, so the parent is not able to say consciously, well, now, child, please do this for me or that for me. It would be much simpler if that were the case, but the child basically has to learn to read the narcissistic parent's mind and meet the need before the need is expressed, and ward off rage or whatever that comes when the need is not met by meeting it ahead of time. And so it's just a great training school for intuition.
And it gets to that trilogy we talked about, rescuer, rescuer, victim, that child often remembers how to be a rescuer.
Right, right. Right, yeah.
But by continuing to rescue, the child becomes a victim. Because it's always rescuing.
That's right.
Never really getting rescued.
Right, and then of course becomes so angry at that at some point that it turns over and he persecutes somebody.
Right.
Somehow I missed your question. I would say, well,
there's a sentence in the book on page 82, first paragraph, growing up with a narcissistic mother is traffic to it too, because there's no point. So I'm curious about what the process is of how that comes to.
I think a lot of us did. I think you may be right. That's the training ground for good therapists. Then we have to learn how to be, how to not meet the needs of our patients in that way.
And that also brings up to me some other things in this book in terms of what we were talking about this morning, of resisting the seduction of getting into that place of ultimate bliss and closing off the door to the back.
By always trying to be, both to be good and to spare our patients or whoever from any of the darkness of life. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
Yeah. That's right.
So the thing that comes up to me is the power involved. It's not what the thing is, it's the identification of the being. Mm-hmm. It's the savior.
The white knight.
The
white knight. Tell us again where you're from. Okay. That was a Tasmanian white knight. Well, the Judeo-Christian, Jesus is a rescuer and a victim, and Yahweh, the Old Testament God, is the ultimate persecutor. Mm-hmm. Raging around her. Now, I don't know if it exists in... Now, Votan is... I mean, there's certainly pieces of this in the Votan. I think it is at least the raging persecutory aspect. And there is the... he makes himself a victim in the process of trying to redeem himself. And he becomes the savior. So, he becomes the savior of mankind by finding the wounds through this act of self-sacrifice. It's really like a very primitive version of the Christian.
Not that they seem to constellate in the, in the equation of being with the numinous, or coming out of the numinous experience, I've been struggling with my identity and narcissistic thoughts. Just a real battle of a feeling like I don't know who I am, and am I relying on, who am I to rely on as to who I am after knowing what I know? I guess it comes back to what Jung said. Once you're conscious, you've got to learn to be decently unconscious. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that fits in.
I'm not sure that fits what you're talking about. I think, how can we even think about the idea of letting God incarnate in us without experiencing a certain amount of narcissism? I think that's part of the territory. The problem is if we get stuck in that place, then once again, it's like we are identified with the God rather than having a meeting with it. And we lose sight of the not quite, the not quite part of it. And then we lose the humanness, and then we just are that God. Mm. In a totally unreflective way.
Okay, so as long as there's reflection, when in that sensation of narcissism, that's stable.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Maybe.
Thank you.
when I read this, I got a pretty good understanding of Lilith. But I didn't like, still didn't like Addisbury, the way it's portrayed in that. It's your dream, of course.
Yeah.
Perhaps
yeah.
The dream wasn't that bad. But what I perhaps projected into this was that Adam has gone from being very controlling to being very passive, which it doesn't sound like much of an improvement to me.
Yeah, there is a lot of passivity in that Adam figure in my dream, and I think that probably is a concomitant of the particular stage of development implied by that emergent Lilith at that moment. It's like a particular stage of the feminist development where women are wrathful and simply opposed to the masculine, and this is the first time the men have heard about it, and they are just sort of sitting back and watching and thinking, gee, what's going on? And this dream really was portraying a moment like that within my own psyche.
So then it's not a sense, it's not a, you're not describing a man who is very well developed in this dream. I mean.
Right, it's just a piece of the masculine in my own psyche who is stunned by...
The first time I saw him, is this supposed to be a role model for me?
No. No. But only if they're in the stage of development I was in at that moment.
Well, it's quite different in that sense I'm using it. In this dream, from going from the Adam of the last 2,000 years who controlled and dominated in the material world, going to somebody who runs away from all that and pulls back from the material world, that feels passive to me. Somebody who doesn't say anything, doesn't have any... See, he hardly says anything in here. And maybe he doesn't say anything at all.
He grins or something.
Yeah, he just smiles,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And as if he's really not involved emotionally with the woman who's portrayed the Lilith.
He went to sleep, right? That's what she says. A few millennium of living with nothing but niceness almost put him to sleep forever.
Another part of him, yeah, the feminine part of him. But here it seems like his masculine part is asleep also. And Lilith is, the feminine has come to the forefront and is controlling instead of the masculine, which doesn't seem like improving.
See, we don't know what would have happened if I had addressed Adam. I didn't address Adam.
Right,
I was focused. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah.
My experience with Lilith is I've greatly been attracted to Lilith types of women all my life. And whenever I get into a relationship with that woman, I would assume that role of passivity to find a way to please her, which is impossible.
Which is fatal.
Yeah.
Then nobody gets redeemed.
I spent, after my relationship was several years ago, or seven, not several, but 4 or 5 years ago, I was in a relationship. I watched it come short of War of the Roses, literally, on a special point, special point of pain or something.
Yep.
You just got to think.
Yep.
But that doesn't stop the attraction from not being there.
Well, that's what I was saying about passivity and control. They both sort of apply to the same point, I mean, that there's just a level of consciousness that's not real effective, either way. If there's a battle for control, or if one person thinks passive, or if both are passive, it's just not very awake state, either one.
Yep, absolutely.
Then there's another kind of passivity, though, which is uninvolved and is not a power struggle. Mm-hmm. So then we're talking about, I think, about two different kinds of passivity.
Yeah.
Huh?
A worry is just there, and something else is going on. The image I have of this particular material is Adam just, I haven't addressed Adam, so he just is present, and he's not necessarily being passive. It's just, it wouldn't be appropriate for him to be talking, because Lilith and I are having this dialogue. But true passivity would be like a compulsion to not say anything if it were appropriate. Or,
what would be an archetypal of Lilith and Eve in the past as a common archetypal? If you take Lilith and take Eve and you were a rounded, more evolved woman, that a man would be born. To have the Lilith and to have the Eve and to have
That's kind of most women. No, it's kind of the way most... Well, I shouldn't say most women. Any woman today who is struggling, say, to have a marriage in which, to some extent, she pleases her husband and doesn't just totally do her own thing, and at the same time to have a career and develop her individuality and do the things that are important to her that don't include him. Anyway, a lot of women are struggling with that issue, and that's Eve and Lilith, both in there. And it's enormously difficult for a woman to do that, to really live both parts of it and to respect her feelings of wanting to take care of her husband in some ways and not just always be confronting him, and at the same time to really live her individuality. It's the problem of being an individual and being a collective being at the same time. It's not just women's problem. It's all our problem somewhere.
Stories of that from a person who doesn't think of men or women because it's not very common.
Yeah, this is really new stuff.
We got the new mythology then.
Eleanor Roosevelt was probably been an example of that, isn't it?
Maybe. Yeah, someone who really was struggling with that problem. Yeah.
Earlier than feminist.
Right.
I'm fascinated by Lilith. Do you have more information?
Sounds like you've got something.
There's a book by Barbara Koltoff, Koltuv, called The Book of Lilith. That's probably what you are really wanting to learn about, though, is the Lilith inside, in which case active imagination is the way to go.
On that subject, how would one, what we're discussing about, how would one climb down the staircase into the unconscious, consciously, and have like dialogue with all the various people down there, to find out what's going on, who wants to say what, before one of them comes up and runs over and ruins the day.
That's the trick.
How would one actively go down in a safe way, like have a rope so you can get back out again?
Well, that's active imagination. Jungians have written quite a bit about that. I have a paper on active imagination in a book called Jungian Analysis that's edited by Murray Stein, and you find some references there too to other writing about it. The image that comes to me about it, though, comes out of, I think, how that came up in our discussion at lunch, and we were talking about, with my husband, when that rage that I describe in the last chapter of this book comes up between us, how do we do the work of redemption? And I was saying, well, for starters, what it means is, you know, the sacrifice of Votan means that instead of trying to kill each other, we walk away from each other and say I'm walking away, and I go into my study and close the door and feel this rage and want to go out there and just rake him over the coals, but I don't do it. When I'm successful in the redemptive process, if I don't do that, one of the things I might do, I might go out back and throw plates and break a bunch of crockery, or I might sit down and start writing in dialogue with the rage, you know, if there was enough of me out of it to do that, then that would be a moment when I'd do it. Now, you were talking about, well, can't you do that before it comes up? And right. Well, yeah, I mean, you can try. But the problem is that usually the way we become aware of these inner figures is through their effects on our life. Otherwise, we don't know they're there. And some of their effects are very destructive. Usually, they have to hit us over the head before we will pay attention to them.
You can go and put yourself in an unfamiliar environment. That may work. I had, I think, kind of experience you're talking about when I was in a sweat lodge ritual. Didn't happen for everybody else, but for me, I lost it. And often the wilderness experiences will do that for people. If you get yourself out of your familiar world, then it makes it easier for the steps to come up.
But that's like having it run you rather than
it's
going down.
The first time you meet it, it's going to.
Well, that's not what I was saying. I was saying going down and sitting at a table with everyone and saying, okay, what do you got to say?
I don't think that's one of our options.
Why not?
Whoops.
Need to become emotionally activated at the point. And if you don't have to go through your emotions, you're not going to find it.
It sounds like you have control to get the movie.
Yeah.
I said it sounds kind of like half interest in the movie.
When I tried to do what you're suggesting, go and get in touch with some rage. It doesn't manifest itself. It's not there to talk to me.
Yeah.
But when I feel the rage, then I can do it. So it just doesn't make itself available when it's not going on. In my time.
Yeah.
Well, that's basically what I've been doing. Like, I deal with it when it comes up. That's what I've been doing up to now. But I'd like to get into the state where, you know, get in before it comes up.
Well, if you're working with it already, then see, it's like if you sit down with it sometime when you're in it, maybe it will personify itself the way Lilith personified herself for me, so that you will then have an image to work with. And then once you've got that image and you have like a setting for the image and so on, you can in fact go and you begin to get little hints before it gets out of hand, and you can go there and talk to it and say, well, what's up, you know, what are you getting so freaky about, you know, what's going on? And sometimes they'll tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can ask, well, what the fuck are you so mad about? You know, why do you think you've got to wipe this guy out? You know, he's just a poor dumb human being. You know, he did something you didn't like very much, but you don't have to kill him for that. What's going on? You know, and maybe it'll tell you. Yep. Very important to write it down. People always, when they first do this, feel like, oh, well, I'm just making this up. Yeah, but if you really take it seriously and get into it, pretty soon it starts saying things that you never would have thought of. And then you realize you're not just making it up. It's coming up from some place that you're not that conscious of.
It seems to me that when I'm in a room, I'm flossing. And the idea of being able to even write seems so foreign to me.
I know.
I know.
I know. Well, another thing you can do is use paint. That's another way of giving it form. You see, archetypes, the rage is carries archetypal energy. It's energy that's godlike. It's bigger than human. Anger is something else. Irritation is something else. But real big stuff. And archetypes manifest in a couple of different ways, and images is one way and emotions are another. So that if you can convert that, if you can find the image that is behind the emotion, then you may find that the emotion, if it doesn't disappear, at least you can get some distance from it. There's something about the image making process that really helps with that. That's it. We're talking about that at lunch too. I was saying it's not my husband who makes me angry. It's that I have this anger, and my husband is particularly skilled at helping me get in touch with it.
When I look back at these things and I think of why I get angry or rage or whatever, it's usually I've totally misunderstood.
That's right.
You know,
yep.
Or
me too. Yeah, when this rage, I mean, this kind of rage is a piece of the emergent God. And in that, in its unconscious primal form, that's one of the ways it comes. And it's just totally demanding and, I mean, it's like the Old Testament God. It's going to have what it wants and the way it wants it. And
so it's mythologically, is that part of that, you know, are we carrying around this mythological Old Testament God in us? Is that what our rage is about, or is it about something else?
You can look at it in two different ways, and I would say both are true. You can say this is infantile rage, and you can say that this is Yahweh or Votan. I think Votan and the Old Testament God are very closely related to one another. And they're both true.
Well, what if you put a different God in there? Or if you take this guy and you say, I don't like this God anymore, I want a different God. I don't like this creation. This is not where I want to be. You know?
you weren't here this morning, right?
No.
I'm just realizing that we spent most of the morning talking about the task of redeeming the of redeeming God and the incarnation of God as the task of the present time. So this discussion of anger falls into that context.
Does it make me angry when I hear talking about God as a thing that's set up from 2,000 years ago? They haven't thought to think about whether this is true or not.
Yeah. Well, you see, we're not talking about dogma. We're talking about psychological facts. And one of the psychological facts is that we experience this rage, and that this rage is like Votan or the Old Testament God, and in fact that those mythologies arose as giving a way of giving form to this inner experience, and that we now that now the God image is changing, and one of the ways in which it's changing is that that material is asking to be redeemed within many individuals. And so you can redeem that. You can't just on a cerebral level throw out the Old Testament God and say, well, I don't believe in that, because you don't have to believe in it. It lives in you. But you can work at redeeming that when you work at redeeming your own rage, you know, and not just acting it out, but confronting it and meeting it. Yeah. I have to think about that a little bit, because it's very, very much to the point. In the 15th and 16th centuries, well, let me back up a little bit. In Ion, Jung really talks about this. And he talks about the two fish of the Piscean era as the first of them being Christ, an image of Christ, and the second of them being the image of the Antichrist. So in the Pisces symbol, we have the problem of the opposites. Now, the first half, and actually the first two-thirds of the Christian eon, or three-quarters, I guess, the mythological imagery that came up was about Christ. And somewhere about in the 15th century, I think, we first began to get mythological images of Faust, who was the one who confronted Mephistopheles. And this corresponds in time to the birth of science. So that at that time in history, there, in a sense, that's when the split developed, or an aspect of the split in the psyche as we experience it. Science came into conflict with religion. I mean, one way in which that was manifested was in the more recently is in the creationist or the biological idea about the evolution of the world, which Jung's ideas sort of bring together. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that whole splitting process began at about that point, when it's like the Christ then was met by the Antichrist, and in some sense, science is the Antichrist. I mean, that's one way of looking at it in relation to the purely theological view of the world. That would be a piece of it, yeah.
What about modern science?
Well, modern science evolved out of that. I think you have something more specific in mind.
I'm trying to think that the new physics is talking about a different concept of reality, the quantum universe, what David Bowman was saying about implicit order and explicit order. And looking at, instead of matter as particles, looking at matter as relationships. And perhaps God or that energy is that energy between the different things that we can give.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now go back to the question, because I've lost the question.
How does modern science?
Okay, I see what you're asking, and looking at it from that point of view, it's as if what happens is that science is evolving in a way that's parallel, or physics, specifically not in physics, is evolving. The images that physics gives us are evolving in a way that seems maybe even an expression of the way that the God image is evolving. Yeah, yeah, thanks. That's a really interesting aspect. I mean, after all, the hypotheses of science are simply that. They often get concretized the way the dogmas of religion do and get taken as if, well, this is the way it is. But mostly they're hypotheses. We know very few facts. Okay. Yeah, just is.
Yeah.
And we can make all kinds of different things about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of some of the aspects of part of physics that is inherently unobservable. And that leaves us in kind of a nice place where people can contemplate about them and draw theories, and but they are unobservable no matter how great we get at observing.
Yeah.
Observing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
one of
another thing that science did, I think, in scientific ethics began to be developed, I think it's that linear cause and effect way it looked at everything, I think helped lift a lot of people out of a lot of fatalism that was existing from the dark ages of Europe, like 500 to 1,000 BC, when there was so much chaos in Europe. And people, I think, had a very stable, if I understand the mentality that was in existence, and there was a lot of fatalism and feeling like you couldn't affect your life and change things. And this is kind of a counterbalance to that. That went too far. In our own, you know, under the 2 years. But in the beginning, I think it helped people think that they could change themselves and the environment they live in. You could be free of oppressors.
Yeah. It's not for nothing that it was called the Renaissance, the rebirth.
Now we're going back the other way. Hopefully, not all the way back where we came from.
That admits that there is an internal order working going on that we can kind of understand mathematically, but what can't. That's what I've read.
It admits
maybe
that
it's different now.
It admits that there's irrationality.
Yeah.
That order of irrationality exists, both exist.
But that irrationality has a shape. It's a statement that the physicists are making. There is a shape to it. And it's mathematical.
What I've done from it.
Yeah. So the shape is something we can understand, kind of, but it doesn't really get rid of it.
But isn't that a contradiction? Because the more science tries to create a shape, and the more I find that is to lose the boundary, or to lose the idea of putting it into a box and being able to dissect it and identify it.
It's the same thing we were talking about this morning about good and evil.
You're kind of clothing yourself. You're limiting yourself potential. You limit your potential by surrounding it with a shape.
The same thing with psychology. I mean, the more you understand the human mind, the less you understand it.
Yeah.
Because you're creating all these constructs about what is happening. You know, this is happening, this person has this particular disorder or this particular syndrome or whatever. But that's a construct, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
What's that Chinese statement that says that specialization is learning more and more about less and less?
Yeah, I mean, the way you try to figure it out is the less you find it.
I have a question in relation to that, bringing in the opposite. I realize that that there's a spirit in me that searches for meaning and eloquence, and it seems to work overtime, most of the time in my life. And I've been working on the opposite of that, imagining that the search for meaning is the animus of the spirit for me in me, and that the feminine in the soul is expressible differently, and asking how can I honor that side.
Mm-hmm.
What would we say? It was just holding the sensations, the emotions and the images.
The image that comes to me as you talk about, I mean, I don't know the answer for you because I don't know you well enough, but the image that comes as you talk about it is that the feminine would be the receiver of that fertilizing spirit that's
I started yoga, and my teacher comes up to me and says, "Too strong." And then I started Aikido, too strong. And it's like, I'm going through the same thing, which I thought I had conquered it, you know, or not conquered, but at least I knew how to wear to soften up in yoga. And
now I would ask you, what does your own psyche say? Does it say that, or...
That I'm too strong?
Yeah. Because your own psyche might have a different idea about that. I mean, that's just a... that's not something I expect you to answer right here, but it's something to think about.
The responses around me as to what the inner responses are, because it's the truth, and where they are true, you mean?
No, I just mean, do your dreams say too strong? Something to think about. It's not to answer right here. But that was just supposed to be a little sidelight. I was going to say something more about what you asked. Oh, the spiral. That Jung's image of the process is that it's a spiral, and it goes. It can be either an upward or a downward spiral, but it goes round and round. Say it's an upward moving spiral. And we come back to the same things over and over and over and over and over and over endlessly. But hopefully, if we're moving, it's on a slightly different level each time. So our consciousness of the same things is a little bit different.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sometimes things do, after a while, stop happening.
Yeah. But there's no point in setting out to make particular patterns stop happening. It's easier just to kind of say, well, this is who I am, and this is my process. And sometimes, miraculously, they go away, and then you can say, thank God. But you don't have to be beating your head against it. You just accept it as part of your fate, part of your stuff.
One of the things that I was talking earlier about dying and growth or rebirth has been interesting for me. I recently reached an age where I am now older than all the male role models I had ever reached.
Mm.
And what that's done for me is sort of freed me up to a great extent.
Mm.
But it's also given me a great dilemma, because when you talk at the very earliest, you're talking about we need a vision in order for the rest of our life. I've got a lot of standards and ethics, but I'm having a hell of a time with a vision. You know, what to do with the rest of my life, because I don't have anybody to look at. But the ones who were dead for a reason when they died, and I don't want to follow those, and I've passed it now, so I don't need to worry about that. But I'm sort of looking at all the older men that I know whom I admire, and I sort of catalog what I like about them. And yet that feels like just that. I'm going through a catalog.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm sort of looking to the dreams. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting process to try to
figure out what my vision is for the rest of my life, however long that is. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything to, no roadmap down here. I'm creating my own.
Yeah, that's a real interesting point. That we're living so much longer
right.
now, too.
Right.
That there are stages of life that have, in some sense, hardly ever existed before.
Right.
More people are living longer. There always have been a few.
But not many did.
It was like 45 or something. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of
well, at least in this man's family, he's living longer than other people.
But I think that it is true. More of us are living longer. We aren't living any longer as a species. We're not living to 900 years, but far more people are over age 65 now than percentage-wise than there ever was before.
It's one thing when there is only one man in the tribe who lives to an old age, and then he is the wise old man in the tribe, and that's the role model.
Right.
But what if they're a whole bunch? Then then what?
That's all. New wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the comments of the founding fathers is so interesting because they start these very individuated people and came out of the context that forced their individuation constantly curled around towards the individuating ideas of that time about liberty and freedom and right and human rights. And so I wonder though that process of individuation and longevity has something to it. You know?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
There is something to this. They're really living in accordance with the self. Mm-hmm. And the dictates of the self in response to the stresses of the mind, rather than succumbing to the stresses of the mind and being in prison and why it's been short to find out. Sacrifice yourself.
Yeah, I agree. I've been thinking a lot about that lately, too. It's as if as long, it's like it's something to live for. That vision is something to live for. And when you reach a certain age, it's very easy. Just if you don't have something to live for, it's very easy just to die.
That's the classical thing that's been inspired.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of the people who provided compensation accounts, they want people to think top and bottom of our lives. Didn't ensure their survival, but the ones who did survive, they just couldn't imagine that they would survive in war or other prisoner war. Somebody's telling a story about a ship that went down and there was a shark hole over the water. Sharks were picking off the spray, and the men were out there in their life jackets floating in the water for 5 days. And some of them just gave up and they climbed out to where the sharks were. And others stayed in the group where they were safer. And one guy was asked, why did you survive and not give up? He said, because I could imagine I had something else to live for beyond this. I thought, I could imagine surviving. And some people give up.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't ensure you live, but it gives you the start and to be done.
Yeah, exactly. It makes me think of, I don't even know how old he was, maybe, I think in his 40s, that Jung had a heart attack and had this near-death experience in which he made a crossing and was told by the ones on the other side that he had to come back and that he was not finished with his work. And he really hadn't done the primary work that we know about at that point. And it was very, very painful for him to come back. But it's like he came back because of meaning, that there was something that he had to do.
But the other part of your question, how to find it, a reason to go. That was the other part of it, wasn't it?
Well, the other part of the dilemma is how to go about that. Dreams certainly are one way. I may not do them to work in terms of writing them all down, but I've certainly worked them through to a great extent, and that's helpful.
Yeah.
Esther, I'll give you an aspect that you quite up with.
Are they? I sort of poo-poo that stuff.
Good look at it.
Okay.
I would guess that we've already survived beyond a lot of others that there's something.
I'm not worried that there's something there. It's not a question of thinking I've got to find something by Monday or I'm gone on Tuesday. It's more a question of sort of being out in a new forest and I don't know the lay of the land and I don't know where anything is. It's like moving to a new town the first week. It's the strangest place. I don't really like it because I don't know it yet. Mm-hmm. After 2 or 3 days, I sort of know the way. You know, how to get around. And that's kind of what I'm going through right at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting and it's a dilemma at the same time.
It's only, that's like a call. That's like a call to individuate. It's like all of the collective, regular, pre-patterned ways of doing it are gone, but you feel pulled by something.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's got to be something there.
Right.
Yeah. It's good.
There's nothing else, too.
Well, I guess so. Yeah.
Well, I think someone said that people die sometimes to be excused from the whole thing. You know, from either from their family or from just trying to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I think that's so.
And then, But if you chose not to be excused, then that's a good way to go, I suppose,
to
go ahead. I suppose others have
maybe chosen. Well, what about reincarnation?
You
have to come back and do it all over again.
Yeah.
In that view, some of the terrors that we do endure are designed to wake us up inside to some purpose or vision. Like, okay, I survived that, too.
Yeah,
and then you feel renewal of the survival.
Yeah.
Self gives
that's right.
The perspective.
That's right.
Self
is on
your
left. Can I give a little preview? A little selfie? Our program here next year is going to be on Seasons of Life. Huh. And it will address all of these kinds of things.
Right.
And I'm sitting here because I did prayer counseling work and work with people who had to make major life changes due to injury and illness. And so we faced a lot of questions, and so I'm listening to all this anticipating that there'll be at least one program on that, but we're going to go through all of the stages of life and are looking for speakers too. There'll be something coming out for people to offer up programs and things like that. So that'll be our 92-93 program.
Yeah.
When you asked, I think you asked about how do we know if we're doing good or evil? Is that what you said?
Well, more like a comment about the shadow, and if there were people that do evil and deny that they do evil, was my comment. It's not only when there's a question came out about there being a lot of good in what we think of as the shadow, which I fully accept and see. And then there are those people who are much more like the Dorian Gray characters who go about doing evil and have no shadow.
Yeah.
You know, that place of not being able to see themselves is like there's a mirror and refuses to make all of us. And it comes up for me because of the nature of the some of my clients and the things and the rationalization of obviously that we're handing to them when I was even clicked on. Really, really serious kinds of things, and people really say, oh, I love you.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really horrible things. And so there's that failure to do the moral reckoning and to make responsibility. And somewhere in the first part of the Green Seminar, you talked about sitting with consciousness and how that has a particular purpose. There are times when we know we're going to be wrong and we go ahead and we do it because there is growth following that particular event that would not have occurred. But then there are other kinds of acts that are in themselves so reprehensible, and there is no growth to the individual. They continue to perpetuate and do harm without grace, without social restraint, without consequence. The things that come to mind are the things about sexual abuse that and what happens in conflict to the numbers of
individuals. Children are probably the only really innocent victims that there are.
I think that's a really valuable point you're making. Yeah.
Janet, you wrote something in theater that struck me real powerful about children. You asked Frances about having toys, and she talked about the teddy bear. She was a baby, and she was quarantined for the teddy bear, and he got burned. I thought it was pretty powerful.
Yeah, it was a pretty horrific thing, wasn't it? And yet, from the consciousness of the time about disease, that was a necessary choice. From the consciousness of today, we wouldn't say that was a necessary choice, right? I mean, I'm talking about the parents who burned it.
The image in your book of the death of the crow, and I can see from the consciousness of the parents at the time of Francis' illness, but what do you do with the death of the crow? Like what?
Well, I do a lot of things with it. What I did at first was rage at whoever did that. And in fact, called the police and the game warden and all kinds of stuff. But what I've done over the years is look at the acts of my own that are equivalent to killing crows, which really have to do with projecting my own stuff on somebody and then trying to do them in.
So when you are looking at evil in the world, then you look inward and say, where is that?
Where is it in me? That is not, incidentally, that is not to deny that it exists out there.
It's like a special power in your perception of it when a bunch of your own. I mean,
that's right. That's it.
I kind of look for that power, and if I see it, I go, whoa, there's something. Be careful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as soon as it has a particular emotional charge for you. And it's like you can look at events like that, and that feeling is as. It's like a spirit guide, you know, that it's a gift, that this is an opportunity to look at a piece of your own evil. Bad things other people say about you, you can look at as a gift, because other people almost always see your shadow more easily than you see it yourself, so particularly your worst enemy. What your enemies say about you are, is provide a good opportunity to look for your own shit.
And a projection there.
Yeah, that's right. It's not our business to make them see their stuff, but we can take the opportunity to see our own. I've been reflecting some about the image at the end of the Kochnik letter where he says, talking about God, he says, his goodness means grace and light, and his dark side, the terrible temptation of power. And I've been working on the question more specifically, what is the terrible temptation of power? I mean, how does that manifest? And what I've been able to come to so far is the idea that because we all need power of a particular kind, that the terrible aspect of power is when we overstep our boundaries. And the issue of boundaries and what belongs to us and what doesn't belong to us and where am I overstepping is precisely where the moral dilemma seems to me to get the most poignant.
what I see is has
anyone I become aware or more aware of, and I find out that especially my work environment that I can become much more manipulative. If I choose, it's real hard to resist sometimes. And I know that by looking at people and seeing them, that I have a deeper understanding of what's going on with them. And I could use that information again. And it scares me that if I were to do that, what would be my consequences?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a big one.
So easy to cross over somebody else's boundaries. No, it's true.
Yeah.
And then you're regarded as you're a girl. You aren't even aware of that. And where it goes from there. What is it? Our struggle with all kind of that.
That's one example. That's right.
What are you sacrificing?
You're sacrificing the God. See, as soon as you identify with the unconscious God, what you're sacrificing there is the unconscious God who is all powerful and who can step over boundaries, step over those human boundaries. And in doing that, you're not sacrificing the whole God. You're only sacrificing its unconscious aspect, and that's a piece of transforming. Have you ever said no to yourself about acting out a piece of rage?
Yeah.
Well, you know what it feels like. It hurts. It's really hard. It is a sacrifice.
But not in the moment of rage.
Well, if you ever do it in the moment of rage, it's excruciating. Mm-hmm. It's just excruciating. That's a sacrifice. It's a very painful sacrifice. A sacrifice is simply a giving up, an offering up of something that you want very much.
But don't necessarily have a right to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did have that experience, and it was like I felt that I was standing on a precipice. I was terrified of heights. I felt that I was standing on a precipice. And at the moment of stopping, I jumped into the void. And I couldn't breathe.
Yeah. It's a real sacrifice. One thing that a sacrifice to the gods often is a burnt offering, and one often feels seared by that kind of a sacrifice.
That's a conscious sacrifice?
Yeah.
What about denying or choosing not to feel the sorrow or those?
That's not a sacrifice.
Okay. It's not a choice not to feel. In either case,
No, you don't get that. No, denial is simply an unconscious cutoff from what's really there. The unconscious self.
Yeah.
Are we ready to 4:30 is the official ending time, but it feels as if we may be ready.
Well, I have a question.
Okay.
This business of sacrificing the rage, would it be considered a sacrifice if, like, you have the feeling to act out a certain thing that it seems to be fair that it should fall out that way, and mm-hmm. sacrifice that actual manifestation and demand restitution in whatever other way, would that be considered a sacrifice?
You got to give me an example, because I don't know what you're asking.
Well, for instance, say, as an example, say someone has a large quantity of some goods that are yours, and you're attempting to get them back, and that person is not forthcoming in giving them back. It's very tempting to get into this, driving over there, tying to the car, and dragging around the block a few times. But if you stop that rage,
mm-hmm.
and sort of give up that return of those goods and say, okay, I'll receive them in some other way, but I want payment for the value of that stuff, would that be considered a sacrifice?
Well, where I see the sacrifice in what you're saying is in giving up the impulse to go drag them around, that's definitely a piece of transformation of primordial rage, piece of transformation of the God image when you say no to that. If you didn't feel it, it wouldn't be that, but to feel it and suffer it and say no to it is a piece of sacrifice. I'm not sure about the, there's a change in level then of what, but you're still I think what you said about, well, I'll ask for something different, I don't think that's a piece of it, but rather the giving up of the impulse to act out destructive stuff.
Well, it's kind of just like you demand payment, and
now, who are you demanding payment from?
Well,
the universe?
Virtually, like, okay, I won't. I obviously can't get it out of that one particular situation, so I feel I need to be reimbursed to compensate for my loss, right?
Yeah.
Loss, literally.
Yeah.
Well, would that be considered a sacrifice to me? Would that be, like, get transformed?
The sacrifice of the sort that I'm talking about is really the not acting out of. In other words, that person has done something destructive to you, and what you want to do is do something destructive back. That's the impulse.
I don't want to do that.
That's the impulse, yeah. Right. And when you say no to that impulse, you are saying no to the unconscious God image.
Right.
Now, beyond that, I mean, the rest...
You with the balance of payment, so
no,
you can't do it that
first. No, that's right.
And neither does the rage, really.
Right. That's
so
right.
Correct.
That's right. It doesn't...
Yeah, because if I don't go and drag him... if I don't go and drag him around the block, I feel cheated.
But mm-hmm. it happens a lot, especially in driving and money, where you're willing to give that up and know that the universe will take care of you later.
Well, is that a cosmic concept, or is that a reality?
I think you have to do everything in your power to get compensated. And then if it is not possible, that's the moment of sacrifice. I think if you haven't done everything in your power, then you haven't done right by the self. But But then there comes the moment when...
That's when you've done everything you can.
War, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that justify war?
What?
Well, you know, if you if thousands of things take over great cities, well, certainly within the power of the United States to bomb the living back
out. No, no, no. Mm-hmm. That's... I'm not talking about some disinterest, presumably disinterested party stepping in. I'm talking about Kuwait doing everything in its power to get its territory back.
But that's the offended party.
Yeah.
Well, say,
but I'm not talking about. I'm talking about individual psychology. Yeah. So let's not politicize it. Right. You can be more conscious in how you're approaching the situation.
Walking away from it because it's not worth, you know, paying your mind with that anymore. I've done that before, and I have found that, you know, this thing about the universe survives, I hate that.
Yeah.
Because it's such a cliche, but I've had the experience of the very next day having an equivalent sum of money handed to me.
But you can't count on that.
You can't count on that.
But you have to.
There is one point that.
I'll
be curious about that too.
I walked away from. I cut my losses. I said, I keep it then. To feel that strongly, keep it. I got on a plane. And, I mean, I was about to get on a plane, and they asked me if I was waiting for the next flight. It's actually more convenient for me than wait for the next flight. And I got a free airline ticket.
And you're connecting that with which makes you uncomfortable.
I'm not connecting it. I'm saying that in a larger picture, I felt compensated. I'm not saying that I did it in order to get the airline ticket. I'm saying that within about 24 hours, I had this feeling like, you know, it was a confirmation that I had done the right thing to let go of the day, to walk away from it.
But that's something you aren't connecting with.
I think she's making a synchronistic connection, not a cause-effect connection. She's seeing meaning in the connection.
Yes, I never
but,
that I would be reimbursed in any other form. I
just was finished with it. And once I finished with it, it still happened
that something wonderful happened. It was not connected,
but
for me, I made
a
connection that I had done the right thing
that I felt.
Rather than let it consume.
Mm-hmm. See, that's the important payoff, with the fact that you don't let it consume you.
Exactly.
My energy that goes out to something like that, I used to resent to an extent that I would get sick. And so by giving it up and the sacrifice, it's freeing me to go on and do something else.
Yeah.
And let that person have it all.
Exactly.
And then if the universe pays me, right?
Yeah. I didn't have to have a fear on it to feel good about it. I had already felt good. The other thing is just
so I think you need to make a distinction. I think we all need to make a distinction in the case you're talking about between getting reimbursed and the desire.
Exactly. Exactly. That's it.
The rage is the desire for revenge and punishment, and that's what we can sacrifice.
Yeah, that's the unconscious God.
Still getting a material good back, it can be separated from that.
Right.
And one can pursue that material object without the other.
Yeah.
Right. No, how much energy, though.
That's another question.
It's separate. Yeah.
That's the principle of it. Right.
Yeah. Okay, let's read this letter again and call it a day. I'm going to skip the preliminaries and get right into the meat. When we consider the data of paleontology with the view that a conscious creator has perhaps spent more than 1,000 million years and has made, as it seems to us, no end of detours to produce consciousness, we inevitably come to the conclusion that, if we want to explain his doings at all, his behavior is strikingly similar to a being with a very limited consciousness. although aware of the things that are and the next steps to take, he has apparently neither foresight of an ulterior goal nor any knowledge of a direct way to reach it. Thus, it would not be an absolute unconsciousness, but a rather dim consciousness. Such a consciousness would necessarily produce any amount of errors and impasses with the most cruel consequences, disease, mutilation, and horrible fights. That is just the thing that has happened and is still happening throughout all realms of life. Moreover, it is impossible for us to assume that a creator producing a universe out of nothingness can be conscious of anything, because each act of cognition is based upon a discrimination. For instance, I cannot be conscious of somebody else when I am identical with him. If there is nothing outside of God, everything is God, and in such a state there is simply no possibility of self-cognition. Nobody can help admitting that the thought of a God creating any amount of errors and impasses is as good as a catastrophe. When the original Jewish conception of a purposeful and morally inclined God marked the end of the playful and rather purposeless existence of the polytheistic deities in the Mediterranean sphere, the result was a paradoxical conception of the Supreme Being, finding its expression in the idea of divine justice and injustice. The clear recognition of the fatal unreliability of the deity led Jewish prophecy to look for a sort of mediator or advocate representing the claims of humanity before God. As you know, this figure is already announced in Ezekiel's vision of the man and son of man. The idea was carried on by Daniel and then in the apocryphal writings, particularly in the figure of the female demiurge, Sophia, and in the male form of an administrator of justice, the Son of Man, in the Book of Enoch, written about 100 B.C. and very popular at the time of Christ. It must have been so well known, indeed, that Christ called himself Son of Man with the evident presupposition of everybody knowing what he was talking about. Enoch is exactly what the Book of Job expects the advocate of man to be, over against the lawlessness and moral unreliability of Yahweh. The recently discovered scrolls of the Dead Sea mention a sort of legendary mystical figure, the Teacher of Justice. I think he is parallel to or identical with Enoch. Christ obviously took up this idea, feeling that his task was to represent the role of the Teacher of Justice and thus of a mediator. And he was up against an unpredictable and lawless God who would need a most drastic sacrifice to appease his wrath, the slaughter of his own son. Curiously enough, as on the one hand his self-sacrifice means admission of the Father's amoral nature, he taught on the other hand a new image of God, namely that of a loving Father in whom there is no darkness. This enormous antinomy needs some explanation. It needed the assertion that he was the Son of the Father, that is, the incarnation of the deity in man. As a consequence, the sacrifice was a self-destruction of the amoral God, incarnated in a mortal body. Thus, the sacrifice takes on the aspect of a highly moral deed, of a self-punishment, as it were. Inasmuch as Christ is understood to be the second person of the Trinity, the self-sacrifice is the evidence for God's goodness, at least so far as human beings are concerned. We don't know whether there are other inhabited worlds where the same divine evolution also has taken place. It is unthinkable that there are many inhabited worlds in different stages of development where God has not yet undergone the transformation through incarnation. However that may be, for us earthly beings, the incarnation has taken place, and we have become participants in the divine nature and presumably heirs of the tendency toward goodness, and at the same time subject to the inevitable self-punishment. As Job was not a mere spectator of divine unconsciousness, but fell victim to this momentous manifestation, in the case of incarnation, we also become involved in the consequences of this transformation. Inasmuch as God proves his goodness through self-sacrifice, he is incarnated. But in view of his infinity and the presumably different stages of cosmic development we don't know of, how much of God, if this is not too human an argument, has been transformed. In this case, it can be expected that we are going to contact spheres of a not yet transformed God when our consciousness begins to extend into the sphere of the unconscious. There is, at all events, a definite expectation of this kind expressed in the Evangelium Aeternum of the Revelations, containing the message, "Fear God." Although the divine incarnation is a cosmic and absolute event, it only manifests empirically in those relatively few individuals capable of enough consciousness to make ethical decisions, that is, to decide for the good. Therefore, God can be called good only inasmuch as he is able to manifest his goodness in individuals. His moral quality depends upon individuals. That is why he incarnates. Individuation and individual existence are indispensable for the transformation of God the Creator. The knowledge of what is good is not given a priori. It needs discriminating consciousness. That is already the problem in Genesis, where Adam and Eve have to be enlightened first in order to recognize the good and discriminate from evil. There is no such thing as the good in general, because something that is definitely good can be as definitely evil in another case. Individuals are different from each other. Their values are different, and their situations vary to such an extent that they cannot be judged by general values and principles. For instance, generosity is certainly a virtue, but it instantly becomes a vice when applied to an individual who misunderstands it. In this case, one needs conscious discrimination. Your question concerning the relationship between the human being and an unconscious, paradoxical God is indeed a major question. Although we have the most impressive paradigm of Old Testament piety that could deal with the divine antinomy, the people of the Old Testament could address themselves to an unreliable God. By very overt attempts at propitiation, I mean in particular the repeated assertion and invocation of God's justice, and this in the face of indisputable injustice, they tried to avoid his wrath and to call forth his goodness. It is quite obvious that the old Hebrew theologians were continuously tormented by the fear of Yahweh's unpredictable acts of injustice. For the Christian mentality, brought up in the conviction of an essentially good God, the situation is much more difficult. One cannot love and fear at the same time anymore. Our consciousness has become too differentiated for such contradictions. We are therefore forced to take the fact of incarnation far more seriously than hitherto. We ought to remember that the fathers of the church have insisted upon the fact that God has given himself to man's death on the cross so that we may become gods. The deity has taken its abode in man with the obvious intention of realizing its good in man. Thus we are the vessel or the children and the heirs of the deity suffering in the body of the slave. We are now in a position to understand the essential point of view of our brethren, the Hindus. They are aware of the fact that the personal Atman is identical with the universal Atman and have evolved ways and means to express the psychological consequences of such a belief. In this respect, we have to learn something from them. It saves us from spiritual pride when we humbly recognize that God can manifest himself in many different ways. Christianity has envisaged the religious problem as a sequence of dramatic events, whereas the East holds a thoroughly static view, that is, a cyclic view. The thought of evolution is Christian, and, as I think, in a way, a better truth to express the dynamic aspect of the deity, although the eternal immovability also forms an important aspect of the deity. The religious spirit of the West is characterized by a change of God's image in the course of ages. Its history begins with the plurality of the Elohim, then it comes to the paradoxical oneness and personality of Yahweh, then to the good father of Christianity, followed by the second person in the Trinity, Christ, that is, God incarnated in man. The allusion to the Holy Ghost is a third form appearing at the beginning of the second half of the Christian age. And finally, we are confronted with the aspect revealed through the manifestations of the unconscious. The significance of man is enhanced by the incarnation. We have become participants of the divine life, and we have to assume a new responsibility, the continuation of the divine self-realization, which expresses itself in the task of our individuation. Individuation does not only mean that man has become truly human as distinct from animal, but that he is to become partially divine as well. This means practically that he becomes adult, responsible for his existence, knowing that he does not only depend on God, but that God also depends on man. Man's relation to God probably has to undergo a certain important change. Instead of the propitiating praise to an unpredictable king or the child's prayer to a loving father, the responsible living and fulfilling of the divine will in us will be our form of worship of and commerce with God. His goodness means grace and light, and his dark side, the terrible temptation of power. Man has already received so much knowledge that he can destroy his own planet. Let us hope that God's good spirit will guide him in his decisions, because it will depend upon man's decision whether God's creation will continue. Nothing shows more drastically than this possibility how much of divine power has come within the reach of man. If anything of the above should not be clear to you, I am quite ready for further explanation. Sincerely yours, C.G. Jung. Yeah, it's all that's why I was saying it's too bad you weren't here this morning, because this is a reread of it.
Yeah. Did you bring extra copies?
No, but it's readily available.
Second volume
of the letters. Yeah.
I'm struck by what
Yeah. It's like we really have to take moral responsibility. We don't want to wipe out science. We don't want to wipe out the advances that we have made. But we have to take responsibility. Yeah. We got to grow up.
So it brings in question the ethical decisions of science. And that it isn't for science anymore. I don't know if it ever was.
If it ever was, yeah.
But
now we can see it that in
itself.
Is that a good place to stop?
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. I'm delighted to to be with a group that can go so deeply into this material.